welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about the deep values of the people who shape our public conversations. Every episode, I speak to someone who has some kind of public voice or public platform, and I try and get a sense of their story, their principles, the way they see the world, and how they have got to where they are now. I speak to people from a really wide range of professional, political, and metaphysical perspectives in the hope that as we listen across these differences, we can all build our muscles of empathy and curiosity. I see it as a form of resistance towards the systems that are continually trying to polarize us and encourage us to see people who are not like ourselves as less than fully human. In this episode, I spoke to Jonathan Haidt. Jonathan is Professor of Ethical Leadership at the New York University Stern School of Business. He's a leading social psychologist and a writer of many best-selling books, including The Happiness Hypothesis, The Righteous Mind, The Coddling of the American Mind, and coming out right now, The Anxious Generation. We spoke about a lot of things, including his sacred value of truth, his atheism, his experiences of using psychedelics, and why he thinks we are overprotecting children in the physical world and underprotecting them and in digital and online spaces. We covered a lot of ground. I really enjoyed this conversation, and there are some reflections from me as usual at the end. I hope you enjoy listening too. Jonathan, we are going to kick off with not your everyday warm-up question, which is, what is sacred to you? And you can take it any direction you like. It's something that you've touched on in your work. Some people like parameters, and I tend to offer a value or a principle which you have at least tried to let guide your life.
Yeah.
But it's just supposed to be a kind of generative provocation. What bubbled up for you as what might be sacred for you?
Well, unfortunately, I've studied this and written about it academically so much that I can't give you some like deep personal spontaneous answer. I'd have to say that at least, I'm speaking, and this will of course become clear in a conversation. I'm an atheist. I'm, born and raised Jewish. I identify as Jewish ethnically and culturally, but I'm an atheist. But I'm an atheist who actually has a very positive view of religion, which I came to from my work. And that's probably why you reached out, and that's probably where we're talking. And so as a secular scientific sort of person, sacred means inviolable. Biblically, it means set apart. Kadosh, I think, is the word. What is inviolable? What would not trade any amount of something, for like your son's little finger? Like, it's horrible to even think about that kind of a question. I guess I would have to say that for me as a professor and a social scientist, what I've lived my life around mostly being sacred is truth. That is, I feel I can never lie. Now, of course, I do sometimes lie. We all do. And then we justify it to ourselves. But there's an ongoing debate going back to before my wife and I were married, that about truth versus beauty. And for me, truth is sacred. And so if someone asks me a question, I answer truthfully. My wife is like, why did you say that? And my wife has what I call aesthetic compulsive disorder. She must make things beautiful. And if so, like the whole thing with the painting bag, that was actually me, like with her. She's going to see this. She must make things beautiful, and she must make stories beautiful. And she will sometimes make stories beautiful. Then I'll say it afterwards. But wait, that wasn't really true. That's not how it happened. But it's a more beautiful story. And so that was always, it's always been a point of tension with us, but it reveals that I treat truth as sacred. And as an academic, I feel we all have to. And that's why it was so upsetting, this, that controversy about whether, whether the president of Harvard had plagiarized, and some professor, everybody does. Like, no, we really don't. Like, that is totally not true. I can't believe you said that. So it's a kind of a long-winded way of saying that I certainly treat truth as sacred, and I see my life's mission and the mission of all of my guild, of all of the academy, is to advance truth. And then so much of my work since 2015 has been that we have just violated that right and left. We've let ideology trump truth you know, it's always been there to a small extent, but man, it's been horrible since 2015.
Mm. Can you think of a particular moment? Many of my guests have not had so much opportunity to think about the sacred. And so when I'm trying to say to them, you know, a lot of the time we can go through life not really conscious of it. I had an academic on called Lois Lee, who'd also struggled it studied it. And she said, you often don't know until it's transgressed. Mm-hmm. You get the ick reaction when someone asks you or invites you to compromise on the thing that is sacred, and you just know that you can't. Have you had moments in your life where it's affected your decisions, where it's shaped the direction that you went in?
Oh, let's see. There was one time in my life when I did something with data that was not proper. And I ended up undoing it, but I was, and it was exactly when I was under pressure. I was a postdoc, so I got my PhD, but I had a wonderful postdoc position, and I was applying for jobs as a professor, and my publication record was very thin. I had a set of experiments that weren't going quite right, and it was about whether disgust changes moral judgment. And I interviewed a bunch of people in a public space in Philadelphia. I was at the University of Pennsylvania. And I went to like a park and I asked people if they'd participate in my study. And I collected all this data. And the effect that I was looking for was sort of there, but it wasn't statistically significant. Mm. I looked closely at the data. And there was a real outlier. And it was a guy who'd been smoking pot while I was interviewing him. And so I thought, you know, I should just cut him. But part of me knew like, you can't just do it post hoc.
Yeah.
And I looked and I found, you know, there was like two people I wanted to cut, and if I used that rule, I'd cut through. Anyway, I just, you know, I somehow sort of persuaded myself that, well, you know, you can justify this. And it was only because I was so desperate to get a job, because I'd failed to get a job my first time on the job market. And so my whole career was on the line. And so I thought, okay, I'll cut these two outliers that it's justifiable. And I didn't feel right about it. And I thought, I'm not going to write this paper up. I'm not going to submit it. Let me collect more subject. To be sure about this. So I collected more subjects and I didn't get the effect. So I dropped that line, but I did feel ick. I did feel like, you know, I was aware that I was doing it and it felt wrong, but I did it anyway for at least a few weeks. And so I think that actually, now that you mention it, that might be that incident actually could well be part of why I, in particular, am treating truth as sacred, I think more so than some other people in the academy.
Mm. Helpful. Well, lots to come back to there. But first, I want to wind back to the beginning of your story and just locate you where you came from. So I'd love you to tell me a little bit about your childhood, and particularly any big ideas that were in the air, philosophical, religious, political, that were formative on young Jonathan when he was running around.
Well, you know, young Jonathan had a very standard, you know, upper middle class suburban American post-war childhood. Born in 1963, raised in Scarsdale, New York, a suburb north of the city. My father was an attorney. Prototypical, quintessential Ashkenazi Jewish story. My grandparents all arrived from Europe, you know, 1907 thereabouts, fleeing terrible conditions, dirt poor, worked in the garment industry. Their children went to college. Their children were successful. So my story is just a very, very typical American Jewish story. And while my parents were raised in a world that had a little anti-Semitism, I mean, America has been fantastic for the Jews compared to anywhere else on the planet. But by the time I came along, it was like nothing. It was gone in the 70s and 80s. It's back now, but it was gone for a number of decades. While I wasn't in any sense an intellectual as a child, I was very curious and I always loved to take things apart. One of my favorite things to do is just figure out how things work. I was always taking things apart to understand how they worked. And I loved the sciences. I thought I'd go into the sciences. And I thought maybe I'd be a doctor. And I went to college. I went to Yale undergrad, majored in philosophy. Relevant would be that I had a sort of an existential crisis my senior year of high school, around age 17. After reading Waiting for Godot and other existential literature. And I was already an atheist by that time. So thinking, you know, well, if there's no God, like, and if the whole earth was destroyed tomorrow, what would it matter? And so it wasn't a clinical depression, but it was a kind of a like, what's the point of everything? And so I just decided to major in philosophy for that reason, which was totally unsatisfying. because American and British philosophy in the 1970s, 80s, 90s was really analytical, dry, nothing to do with the meaning of life.
It's more like math.
It's just this, right, it's a high systemizing, it's just not satisfying. But I took some psychology courses, which I loved, and I loved my literature classes. So I sort of thought like, you know, great literature and psychology, like that's actually how you get to the meaning of life. Like that really does it. So I majored in psychology. I'm sorry, I majored in philosophy with a psychology track, a sort of a psychology minor. Right. And I got summer jobs in computers. This was the early 80s. So it was PCs were everywhere and I learned to program. Mm. So I thought that I was going to, I didn't know what to do with my life. But I was had those interests and I got a job writing computer programs for the US government through one of my professors. And I lived in Washington, DC for 2 years after college graduation and was so bored and kept thinking every day, what am I going to do with my life? It was a real sort of chronic anxiety.
Yeah.
And then I made a list of, I made a list of what are all the things that really matter to me? What are the things that I really don't want? And it was like, you know, money would be nice, but it wasn't essential. Whereas being around smart, interesting people who are not just after money, like that was essential.
Yeah.
And I listed all these things. I looked at it and it said, oh, you should be a college professor. That's what the list said. And I was like, that had never occurred to me ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was from that that I decided to apply to graduate programs. Originally, I was going to apply in computer science and go in artificial intelligence. But that felt sort of too dry and dull once I got into it and visited a few schools. Yeah. And on a almost on a whim, I ended up applying in psychology, thinking I'd go into cognitive science. And once I was, only one school took a chance on me, Penn. And once I got there, I switched my topic from sort of cognitive science and the psychology of humor. I thought I would do. I switched it to the study of morality. And once I got that, it all clicked, and I never looked back. And it's allowed me to study everything in the world.
How much do you trace that interest to what were those kind of questions live in your childhood? Was there a sense of kind of discussion about politics or about meaning? Were your parents more religiously Jewish? Do you feel like they planted a seed that you pulled on, that you followed about the meaning of life, or not at all?
No. My mother was very literate, cultured. I got a lot from her in terms of just a broad cultural upbringing. And my father, and I only found out at the end of her life that she'd been an atheist all along. She just thought it was important that we be exposed to religion to make a decision for ourselves, my sisters and I. And my father, I think, was a little more religious. And he and I would sometimes argue as I was becoming an atheist, you know, about God and is there a God?
Yeah.
But no, I think, you know, personality is highly heritable. And while, of course, my parents gave me my genes, I think like the way, I see it in my own kids. Like we see it, the way you are, the things that really turn you on, that's not what you learn. That really is just the way your brain works. And so, you know, even though it never occurred to me to be a professor when I was young, I can't believe how lucky I am that I have this job that so perfectly fits who I am and what I want to do.
Yeah. This is a very private question, but do you remember why you became an atheist?
I remember that at my bar mitzvah, I was not an atheist. So when I was 13, Jewish kids, you just take part in the Saturday morning service and you read a part of the Torah rather than having the rabbi read the whole Torah section. And so at 13, I know I was not an atheist, but neither was I religious. But around 14 or 15, I remember having arguments with my best friend, Krister, whose father was a reverend, was a minister, Episcopalian. And, I remember, and Krister eventually went to divinity school, when I was actually at Penn, when I was getting my PhD there. But I do remember at 14 or 15 having arguments with him. It was really just the basic, like, atheism 101. Well, evolution explains this, and why would God create parasites? Or what? I didn't have that sophisticated an argument back then. But it's just very basic. stuff. Again, if you take the Bible literally, it can't be true. Really? You think Mary was a virgin? Mm-hmm. It just didn't seem very likely to be that stuff. So that's all.
Yeah. And then you've said, as you were kind of studying psychology and pursuing that thread, that you use this phrase, I was the kind of guy who would have been a new atheist and then something else happened. What stopped you going down that path?
Well, So to say that I would have been a new atheist refers to, there was, of course, there was, especially Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, there was a set of these guys. They were always men who were amazing writers. I mean, that was actually quite beautiful about them and their writing, especially Dawkins and Harris and Hitchens, Christopher Hitchens. Mm. So they certainly made it fun and exciting. But they all took the Bible literally and then said, like, this clearly isn't true and evolution is true. And they had an animus towards religion, which I used to have. I read the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament in college, and I was shocked. I was really shocked at some of the things that God commanded the Israelites to do. Mm. And I thought that, religion was generally a pernicious force in the world. I was on the left, never far left, but I was, sort of standard progressive type person and as a late teen in my 20s. So for all the, and of course, unfortunately, what's happened in America the last 30, 40 years, Democrats and Republicans used to be sort of equally likely to go to church, but that really has segregated. And especially as the left has embraced gay marriage in particular, that really drove a wedge where people on the left just automatically thought, oh, you're Christian? You're homophobic. By definition. Yeah. So while that wasn't quite me, but it was just sort of in the water in the 80s and 90s and into the 2000s. So as I went into the sciences and psychology, I should say, I was sort of on track to be the sort of person who would write about religion and, show all the foolishness of it. But instead, what happened to me was two things. One was because I was studying morality from an evolutionary perspective, it became really clear to me, a very influential book for me was David Sloan Wilson's book, Darwin's Cathedral, who makes the argument, what's crucial here, this will take a little while to get into, maybe we won't do it now, but does evolution just work on the individual or does evolution work on groups? Because groups actually do compete with groups and groups do replace other groups. And we are all the descendants, not just of the individuals who prospered, but of the groups that did. And it's really clear, groups that are religious are more cohesive, they have more trust, they can do more. So there was that intellectual thread. And at the same time, in my work on moral psychology, I was studying conservative liberal differences. And when I was actually reading the writings of intelligent, the best conservative writing, I was like, wow, I never encountered these ideas. This is actually right. Like this, from a social science point of view, family and tradition and structure and authority and constraint, like, wow, people really need these things. And this kind of society that progressives push for actually tends to fall apart. So a bunch of things converged. Oh, and then the third thread was writing the happiness hypothesis and really reading the religious tradition, reading like every piece of wisdom literature I could find, East and West, and categorizing and organizing it and realizing like, there really is an accumulated body of wisdom that comes largely from the religious traditions, although many modern secular people have come to the same view. But just to see that religions that have evolved over time, that's the key thing. Hmm. Religions that have evolved over time tend to evolve culturally to create ordered and not always humane societies, but usually, and especially in America, where religions had to compete with each other for converts, they have to be really nice. Whereas there are other parts of the world where it's not like that and religions can be much more brutal. So I don't want to defend religion everywhere. But at least in America, where we have a free market, religions actually really do make people nice on average.
Mm. Yeah. I was going to build up to this later, but it's related to what we've just been talking about, which is, I speak to quite a lot of people on this podcast who've come to a similar position to you. I spoke to a guy called Freddie Sayers, recently, who's famously a guy called Matthew Taylor in the States, who's like third generation atheist. And Freddie says he's been speaking to Richard Dawkins recently and pushed him and said, do you believe that religion is like, is gives us evolutionary benefits. Basically, do you believe it is generally good for society? And he sort of agreed that it was. I haven't gone back and checked the transcript, so I want to. But this is Freddie who was interviewing his report of this situation. And Freddie I have lots of academic male friends, many of whom who've done this like new atheism to warm and open move. Mm-hmm. But the thing they say to me, you know, late at night over a bottle of wine is, I can see it's good for society. I can see it's good for individuals, but I just can't get there.
Yeah.
Do you mind, as far as you feel comfortable, sure. Why can't you? What stops you? What holds you back? Yeah. And this isn't adversarial or, I'm just really curious about it.
Yeah. So I'll answer that both as a psychologist and as a person who's had a certain class of religious experiences. So as a psychologist, I'll say that, you know, there are sort of two master dimensions of both brain development and personality. They are systemizing and empathizing. And people who are high systemizers tend to be attracted to math, logic. They can read subway maps. You know, they like to understand how systems work. And I'm a high systemizer, as are all of the new atheists. And then there's empathizing, which is, you know, you feel others' pain. You like to think about people and their motives. And, you know, like most men who are systemizers, I'm lower than average on empathizing. And so I'm just, you know, that's like what a science person generally is. Not always. You can be high on both. Like Bill Clinton is famous example of someone who was incredibly high on both. And that made him a political superstar, even though he had other difficulties. So this is a long roundabout way of saying just the way my mind worked, the way I approached the universe, evolution, science, that all makes sense. The other stuff doesn't. Whereas for many people, they feel it in their heart. They feel it. Now, I was raised Reform Jewish, which means we have bad music, not a lot of ritual. Most of the service is in Hebrew, which is when you're a kid is incredibly boring. So there was just wasn't much there for me when I was growing up. Whereas I could see, in adulthood, I could see that for Christians, especially in some denominations, where they sing and dance, they have sometimes really good music, they build these beautiful cathedrals, some of the denominations, where synagogues are usually not like that. I belong to a beautiful synagogue in New York City, Central Synagogue, which actually is really thrilling and uplifting. And we have a fantastic rabbi who does give inspiring sermons. So I do have more of it now than I did when I was a kid. So it's just an intuitive thing. I think religious feelings come from people's hearts and their experiences. And some people have them. They have a calling. They feel the Holy Spirit. Some people don't. Now, that's the first part of my answer. The second part is that as I was preparing to go do research in India when I was a postdoc at the University of Chicago in June of 1993, I was preparing to go in September, and I was at Chicago, and I went back to Penn, the University of Pennsylvania, where with my grad school friends, and one of them got LSD, and we all tried it together, and it was my first time trying LSD. I was 29 years old, That was, in so many ways, it was very much the kind of religious experience that William James writes about in The Varieties of the Religious Experience. It was very much, you can go down the list. There's 33 features of spontaneous peak experiences, according to Abe Maslow. Do you know the book Religions, Values, and Peak Experiences? Yeah, it's a brilliant little book. I recommend that to all your listeners. Yeah. Whether you're religious or atheist, please read Religions, Values, and Peak. It's a fascinating, it describes the psychology. Mm-hmm. So I had that psychology. Everything looked beautiful, like really beautiful. Dualisms were transcended. There was a sense of pervasive meaningful. I mean, all the features. So I had a full-blown, deeply religious experience from that. And that kindled an extraordinary interest for many years in psychedelics. Now, I'm comfortable talking about it with you now. I sort of kept it hidden for a while in the 90s.
Of course.
But since Michael Pollan wrote his book, what's the title?
How to Change Your Mind.
Yes, thank you. Since Michael Pollan wrote How to Change Your Mind, and now there's all this research coming out on the benefits
of psychedelics. The stigma's gone a bit.
Exactly. The stigma's gone. That's right. But what I can say, so as a, you know, here I am a PhD in psychology, I instantly was like, okay, how do these things work? What are they doing to the brain? I read the cultural history. There's a fantastic book called Storming Heaven, A Cultural History of LSD. That was just thrilling to read. Yeah. So I learned a lot about it. I grew mushrooms with my then girlfriend and as my postdoc. We explored them together. So I feel like that has all given me a much better understanding of religious experience, just as a psychologist. It has opened, on these drugs, sometimes you get sometimes get the feeling you're being contacted by alien intelligences. Like that did occasionally happen. Mm-hmm. So, even though I believe that's just a drug effect, if you at least have the experience of feeling like there are other dimensions of reality and there are other intelligences out there, then at least it becomes more plausible. Not that I don't think that that is true, but I'm really open to the idea that it could be, that I really don't know. And the universe is certainly far weirder than we can possibly imagine. And boy, does it look weird as is.
Yeah. I'm so glad you brought this up. And I promise I have read all of your books for this. And we will, if we have time, we will get to my planned questions. But I wanted to offer you a, it's not a hypothesis because I'm not an academic, a hunch that I have.
You can still offer a hypothesis.
Okay.
You don't need a license. Hypothesis.
Thank you. Okay. My amateur hypothesizing is, so my friends who are male academic leading people, what's happened in recent years is they have been taking psychedelics and the psychedelics has made their previously often new atheisty materialist worldview. They've lost faith in that worldview.
Yeah.
And for a not insignificant proportion, they would say that then enables them one person said to me, fascinating, complete like 360 turnaround in his life, said the mushrooms weren't the religious experience, but the mushrooms made me open enough, made me able to open my heart to the religious experience. And regular listeners will laugh because I'm always quoting Martin Buber, Blaise Pascal, or Ian McGilchrist. But sometimes I wonder if the heritage of my kind of charismatic conversion and then being immersed in the rituals and practice of both charismatic and contemplative Christianity has meant my kind of right hemispheric forms of attention. Basically, the idea of God seems plausible to me. In a way that when you have very left hemispheric forms of attention, and new listeners, I'm sorry, I will unpack this for you in the reflections at the end. We're not going to do it now because Jonathan knows Sally what I'm talking about. And that what psychedelics can do is just open that space to see what I would say is actually an already there, but is that our inattentional blindness makes it difficult for us to see. How does any of that land?
Oh, that lands perfectly. In my academic research, so what the core idea in my main book, the book describing my own work, is The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. And the first principle of moral psychology is intuition comes first, strategic reasoning second. So I'm an intuitionist, and in everything I do, I try to first trigger intuitions, get the right intuitions, get the right sort of emotional framing or background. And then when you put in your main idea, now it all fits and the person has a feeling of, yes, that all connects. And this is why it's so hard to persuade people normally of political things, is that people don't take the time to look at it from the other person's point of view and build from where they are. Anyway, again, I always do this. I always do like, you ask me a question, I'll give you a little psychology first. That's what I'm doing.
That's great.
I'm like, you ask me a question, and I'm like, okay, first let me build a little psychological bed for it, and now I'll put the baby in the bed. As a sort of, rationalist, science-oriented kid, the idea that, Jesus was was the son of God, and he came about by man. I mean, this all seems so implausible to me. And when I... so when I thought about religion, it was within that framework that would lead one to be a new atheist. Like just taking everything very literally didn't make sense to me. But having these experiences, having these experiences intuitively, emotionally, while also coming intellectually, I figured, oh, right, it was only after I had those experiences, much after, right, that was that I did the research on religion about the evolution of religion. So perhaps when I encountered all that thinking about the evolution of religion and if I had not had those psychedelic experiences in the 90s, I might not have been as receptive as I was. Mm. So I guess what I'm saying here is I totally see how psychedelics, what it feels like is it just shatters your constructs and you then have to rebuild. Mm. And that actually right there is a definition of awe. I have a review paper, a literature review paper with Dacre Keltner at UC Berkeley, where we, it was the first review paper on awe from a psychological perspective in 2003. And what we concluded from a lot of our reading of other people's theories was awe happens when two things happen. One is a perception of vastness. The mm-hmm. second is a perception that you can't fit it into your existing constructs. And yeah. when you look at religious conversion experiences, Saul on the road to Damascus, Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, me taking acid for the first time, you have that. It shatters your constructs, then you have to rebuild. And mm-hmm. I was like, wow, what just happened to me? I'm going to learn everything I can about this scientifically. Like, mm-hmm. what happened? That was incredible. But I can totally see other people are like, wow, what happened to me? I'm going to investigate. How much further can I take this? This is like a glimpse of heaven. Like, how do I want to get back there. Mm. And I think it's relevant that a lot of the pioneers of psychedelic, you know, the whole psychedelic movement in the 60s, I think very few of them stayed with psychedelics a lot. Like, a lot of them moved on to Indian religions. So there is a kind of many other religions, you know, people became spiritual seekers. So I think that is a natural evolution.
Yeah. Fascinating. So you wrote the happiness hypothesis became this sort of, leading light in positive psychology. And then the righteous mind came along. And one of the things you talk about in that, and you can see the seeds of it in the happiness hypothesis, mm-hmm. That's what I have loved about reading all your books in order is the seed of the next book is in the one before. And it's just like following a little thread. But is it fair to say your kind of identity as a liberal got complicated or you lost? Tell me a bit about that identity shift, because you went into it thinking, how can I help the Democrats mm-hmm. use psychology to win elections? And that's not where you came out.
That's right. Yeah. So we have to do two things. One is we have to talk about the word liberal, which etymologically is from liberty. What is the life or virtues of a free person? The liberal tradition is a tradition of freedom of religion, free markets. And in Europe, you've largely kept the word liberal close to its, you know, some connection to its original meaning of liberty. In America, sometime in the early 20th century, we did this really confusing conflation of liberal meaning left. Mm. And that is what's confused everything. So yes, I always used to be a liberal because I, you know, liberal, left, Democrat was all the same thing. And it seemed to me, and it might have made sense for us, because it seemed to me that a liberal wants liberty for everyone. And so if you're in favor of gay rights, civil rights, women's rights, then you're on the left and you're a liberal. And if you're in favor of the old order, which is patriarchal, then you're a conservative. So everything seemed to line up, at least in America, to say the liberal is, you know, liberal means left. And then Ronald Reagan pointed out a lot of the contradictions. Ronald Reagan poisoned the word liberal so that the American left, which had a huge long losing streak, from the early 70s until Bill Clinton, and is, I think, about to have another huge long losing streak for the exact same reasons as it did in the 70s. So the word liberal was poisoned for a while, and the word progressive replaced it. So Democrats would say they're progressive. And so I was, you know, I was that, like almost every other academic. And as the American culture were heated up, I mean, you know, you have some similar issues sort of in the UK, but nothing like the intensity that we have of our hatred of between left and right and our, so as that heated up, as George W. Bush became president, who I thought was a terrible president, as the Democrats kept losing to, you know, they lost twice to George W. Bush in elections that I thought they should have won, and I was like screaming at the sky or screaming at the television, like, why do you keep saying these stupid things? Like, don't you understand how American morality works? Like, the flag is important, and immigration...
It's sacred. That's
right. The flag... Yes, exactly. That's right. The left has a lot of trouble with sacredness, and the right sees many things as sacred. And, you know, if you think the borders of the country and the citizens are important, and that a nation is an emergent entity, well, then, you know, immigration is not a problem, but illegal immigration is, or immigration without assimilation is. And the Democrats have never been able to understand that. So I kept trying to say, like, here's why you keep losing. Here's what you have to say. And I did some empirical research to back this up, and I developed moral foundations theory. And I started to then write up, and I gave my first TED Talk in 2008 was on this theme. And if you look at that TED Talk, it really was a kind of a, like, my manipulative way to lecture my liberal audience by putting them at ease intuitively at first, by making fun of conservatives, and then kind of showing, here's, you know, let's make the medicine go down. That didn't work very well. I mean, the talk was relatively popular, but it had, you know, no real effect on the Democratic Party. Anyway, so it was while writing The Righteous Mind, I decided to write up a whole book on this. And I thought it was going to be in that genre of books. George Lakoff has, you know, Don't Think of an Elephant. There are so many progressive intellectuals who've written books on what the Democrats need to do. And I was going to write another one. But I committed, while working on The Righteous Mind, this is like 2009, 2010, I committed to really understanding conservatives in order to write about them. And so I, you know, we had cable TV and TiVo back then, you could record things. So I'd record like the Glenn Beck show. I mean, these are, you know, your audience is international, but these are, you know, right-wing commentary. I would record these shows that were kind of taboo. Like, if you're on the left, how can you watch that? Like, you know, you can't watch that. And those were fascinating because I saw, like, wow, you know, I can see what they're doing. And some of it is, you know, over the top manipulating, but actually, you know, they sometimes make some really good points. And I subscribed to National Review, which is the premier, conservative magazine in the United States. And the writing was really good. You know, people like Jonah Goldberg, I mean, he was funny and incisive, and it was a real pleasure to read. And I learned so much from reading the best conservative writing. And then reading some conservative sociology. There used to be some. There isn't any now, practically. But you know, there's some, you know, Robert Nisbet. I mean, there's some amazing sociologists who understood the need for order, structure, and tradition. And so all these things came together so that by the time I got to writing, I think it was chapter 8 of The Righteous Mind, which is called The Conservative Advantage, where I lay out, you know, on fairness, here's what the left believes, equality of outcomes. Here's what the right believes, proportionality, karma, you know, and that always wins. Like, that's what human beings mostly believe. And after writing that chapter about, especially about fairness and liberty, I said to my wife, you know, I don't think I can say I'm on the left anymore. Like, I think, we need both sides. And this is the yin-yang thing, which you picked up at the end of it, the happiness hypothesis. Like, you really need the tension of opposites. I mean, that's Heraclitus. That's so much ancient wisdom. Like, you need the tension of opposites. So that's where I came to by the time I wrote the book. I'm no longer on the left. I'm no longer on any team. You know, I still continue to vote for the Democrats because I thought the Republican Party was sort of, I mean, Mitt Romney is a wonderful man. That wasn't a mistake. But like, the party was becoming stranger. And, you know, of course, now it's gone off a cliff, the Republican Party. So yeah, I'm not on a team. I'm not on the right or the left. I suppose a passionate centrist in that I believe not that the answer is always in the middle. It's not, but that if you don't have a sort of a responsible center right party pushing against a responsible center left party, you're not likely to get good policy. And so in America, we haven't had good policy in a long time, and we may never have it again.
Did you lose friends when that happened?
I didn't lose friends. I lost a number of acquaintances, but I was never canceled. So, there were definitely, you know, in the academic world, it depends a lot on your department. And so I think there are many people, so put it this way, the far left hates me. People on the far left, they will not read my works. They don't actually know what I say, but they've all heard that I'm a conservative or I'm a fascist or I'm, you know, I'm right adjacent because, you know, if you've ever taken geometry, if you're a centrist, you are literally right adjacent. That is true. So people on the far left, many of them really do dislike me, but I'm actually pretty popular. Center left to center right and libertarians actually all love me because those groups, they can all see the extremity. They can, you know, center left, you know, sort of progressive or, you know, democratic intellectual, like they all see the crazy stuff going on the left, which is poisoning the Democratic brand and pushing people with a shovel towards Trump. Mm. So actually the center left, they tend to really like the righteous mind. And I'm very pleased. President Obama has referred to me in a couple times. Like I know, you know, I mean, he's the sort of liberal that I think is very admirable, and that, you know, that I do still call myself a liberal in that sense. I believe in individual liberty. I believe that the purpose of the state is to help individuals flourish. That's the evolution.
That's really helpful context, because I came to this interview having known your earlier work and known The Righteous Mind really well. And it was actually one of the influences early on in the podcast for wanting to listen deeply to different perspectives. One of the ways that asking people what sacred is to them, sometimes it surfaces moral taste buds. Sometimes it brings out the kind of things that you put on different sides. But I hadn't checked back in with your work for a while. And The Coddling of the American Mind, the article, and then the book, sort of seen it go by in the world of ideas. The title did make me go, huh, maybe he has taken a more, maybe that transition away from the left has taken a more direct turn. I have very weirdly eclectic political people in my life. And when I said I was interviewing you, those who were on the harder left did go,
yeah.
Ugh. He, you know, he doesn't understand identity politics, blah, blah, blah. And I said, oh, have you read it? And they all said no. And so then
They're literally not allowed to read me. They never, ever read me. They never, ever write a response. They just call me names.
Yeah. So then I came to it. And one of the things you do early on in the book is you go, we didn't love the word coddling. Mm-hmm. And by coddling, we did not mean... You're very careful to say this is not sneering, this is not denying problems, this is out of care and concern for a generation.
Overprotected. Coddling means overprotected.
Exactly. It doesn't have a cultural tone to it. It doesn't have a war on woke tone to it. Right. It has a very careful sense of how sometimes ideas work and the power of the stories that we tell ourselves and what that means for our resilience. So I'd love you to talk about that, but particularly, forgive me, this is incoherent, but in the noisy tribal information environment, one of your earlier books has a very dry title. I can't remember what it is. I was looking at them, but it's something very factual and dry, and thus I'd never heard of it. The Coddling of the American Mind does not have a dry title, so it achieved cut through, but put off a bunch of people who assumed you were saying something that you are not saying. Well, as you're trying to navigate that as someone with a public voice, how do you reflect on that dynamic and what your role in it is?
Yeah. So I when I got to NYU, I wrote a mission statement. When I got to NYU Stern, here I am at a business school. I spent most of my career at the University of Virginia in a psychology department. Mm. And when I got to Stern, business setting, learning about business, everybody has a mission statement. So I wrote one. And I think it was basically, my mission is to use my research and that of others in moral and social psychology to help important institutions, to help people understand each other better and to help important institutions work better. And I could see that the culture war, the left-right culture war, was causing people to adopt positions that are really stupid and destructive, but nobody can question them because then you're giving comfort to the other side. And a lot of things were being done. Young people who were on the left or in progressive spaces were being steeped in a set of ideas about victimhood and oppression, which are many of them are factually wrong in terms of their claims about history and their claims about the level of racism and sexism today. But they are psychologically devastating. And this was Greg Lukianoff's great insight. Greg, who was the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, saw that students were saying, like, we have to get this speaker disinvited because if he comes and says these things, people will be traumatized, bodies will be ripped up. You know, people will be not just psychologically trauma. People will die. Like, really, how are they going to die from a talk that they don't have to go to? And so we were like, where do these ideas all come from? Because it wasn't like this in 2012. You know, in 2012, students would come to class, you could give a lecture, they would talk with you about it. But by 2015, some students, not most, but some were just waiting for you to say anything they could be offended by. And then they'd report you or they'd raise a fuss or they'd tweet about it. And so in 2015, we had this transformation of higher ed in which it really was a cultural revolution. I mean, it was very much like the Chinese Cultural Revolution. It was this, you know, young people led, pulling down professors, pulling down statues, destroying, you know, in China, it was the four olds, get rid of everything old. Very much a cultural revolution dynamic. And hardly anyone in the academic world stood up to it. Now, conservatives were up in arms about it, but they didn't matter because they weren't in the academy. And so I was one of the few. I mean, there are others, you know, Steven Pinker, Jonathan Zimmerman at Penn. I mean, there's a number of us who really were writing about this. And actually, coincidentally, at the same time that Greg and I were writing the Coddling article in 2015, independent of that, I co-founded Heterodox Academy because I could see that since everyone's on the left, we're getting a lot of things wrong. Anything about, you know, immigration, inequality, gender, race, like, since people can't really talk about it without getting shot if you disagree, we end up reaching stupid conclusions that backfire. So I think that's a role that I've played, and I've tried to navigate that very carefully. So I've never been canceled. There was one talk at a school in New York City where I was, you know, they paid me to give a talk, and then some people objected, like, you can't have Jonathan Haidt. So they canceled it out of fear. But that's the only time I've ever been, like, sort of literally canceled. So I have tread very carefully, in part because I study moral psychology. So I kind of feel like, you know, I can see the operating system here. I can see where the tripwires are. So I'm going to step over them carefully. Whereas other people, once they get angry, they just, like, go charging ahead, and then you get right into the left-right dynamic.
So the Coddling of American Mind was about overprotecting in the real world, and the Anxious Generation about underprotecting online. What has the journey been to writing this book?
So the journey, it comes directly out of the Coddling. So Greg and I published the Coddling of the American Mind, the book, in September of 2018. And immediately some psychologists and psychiatrists challenged us and said, there's no epidemic of teen mental illness. It's just an illusion. It's another moral panic. You know, young people, they're just very comfortable saying that they're depressed and anxious, but that's a good thing. They're honest about it. And so I was like, wait, did we get this wrong? Like, I really have to look into this. And so I started putting together these Google documents to collect all of the data I could find in the United States and the UK, and then later have expanded it to many countries. And then others challenged us because we said very gingerly in the book, we said, you know, social media and phones, you know, the timing is exactly right. Like, we don't know, you know, correlation doesn't imply causation, but maybe smartphones and social media also contributed to this. And we said that very tentatively. And then some people said, you're doing moral panic again. There's no evidence. It's just correlational.
Yeah.
And so I created another Google document. These are all public Google documents. If you go to jonathanhaidt.com/supplements, jonathanhaidt.com/reviews. I have dozens of these open source literature reviews because I couldn't keep it all straight in my head. Mm. And once I put it all together, like, one document shows it is a, I mean, I hate to catastrophize, but it is a tidal wave. It is an epidemic of mental illness. It hit kids in all the English speaking countries in 2013, plus or minus a year. It hit girls especially hard in the same way. Rates of self-harm and hospitalization for self-harm skyrocketed for girls in all the English speaking countries at the same time. There is no other explanation for this. No one has come up with, even with a theory to explain it other than, to come back to our story. I was looking at the epidemic and then looking at the evidence that it is tied to social media and smartphone use. Mm. And so I began debating with people, and I would do this very publicly, and I would put things out there, and I would invite criticism. And this is something I learned from studying moral psychology. If you ask the world to make you smarter, they will. Just say, you put it out, and people, and Twitter is actually really good for this. You put something out, people will call you all kinds of names, but they'll raise all kinds of problems, and most of the objections are not relevant, but some are. So, you know, as I refined my view and got more and more confident, okay, this is a huge epidemic. It's international. And here, this is work done with Zachary Rausch, my research assistant, my lead researcher, who's done an amazing job tracing it out over many countries. once we were solid on the evidence that it's international, it starts around 2013, and it's very closely linked to social media, I decided actually to write about this more. Originally, it was going to be one big book about how social media is damaging teen mental health in the first chapter. And then I was going to go on to democracy, because that's in a whole nother thing that we haven't talked about, is what social media has done to liberal democracies. But once I started writing that book, it was going to be called Life After Babel, Adapting to a World We May Never Again Share. And I wrote chapter one, which was going to be, look what happened to the kids. They're the first ones who went on. Look what happened. Now let's look at democracy. That chapter was so shocking. And it was like, oh my God, like I can't just say, look at the disaster. Now let's talk. It's like, okay, why did this happen? So I had to say, well, you have to look at childhood. What is it that children have to do during childhood? And how is it that a phone-based life stops them from doing that? And then I had to have a whole chapter on girls, because girls are uniquely suffering. But I couldn't leave out the boys. The boy story is different and it's a little more complicated. So anyway, by the time I had four chapters, I realized, wait, this has to be its own book. And so I made that decision in, I think, the fall of 2022. And then wrote The Anxious Generation in the 12 or 14 months after that. But now to pick up, just to summarize, sorry, I left it hanging. What's the theory? What caused it? The explanation that we offer, that Zach and I offer in the book, and this is also Jean Twenge is another collaborator who's crucial here, and she was the first one on the case. The theory is that from millions of years BC through around 1990, kids had a play-based childhood, like all mammals. All mammals have to play. That's what we have to do to wire up our gigantic brains. So we had a play-based childhood, but in the 90s, we begin freaking out in America and in Britain and in Canada. We freak out about child abduction and child molestation. We start keeping our kids inside, just as technology is luring them inside, because now everyone's got a computer, you got video games. Every year, the video games are better. So the kids are leaving real-world experience. They're not seeing each other as much anymore. They're not going outside. They're not going into nature. They're not being independent. They're always at home, not much more often at home, in front of a screen. And that goes on from 1990 to 2010. But mental health isn't falling in this period, actually. It's actually pretty stable. And the kids are on flip phones. Yeah. And a flip phone is very useful for communicating with your friends. Yeah. And it's not useful for broadcasting to the world. You can't do that with a flip phone. So in 2010, very few kids have an iPhone. It came out in 2017. It's 2007. It's still expensive. So in 2010, very few kids have an iPhone. In 2015, the great majority of kids do. So between 2010 and 2015, we went from flip phone with low speed internet and no apps to iPhone with a high speed internet, unlimited data plan, and a million apps, especially Instagram. Facebook buys Instagram in 2012. That's the year that the huge publicity, that's when all the girls get on, is 2012. And 2013 is when their mental health falls off a cliff.
It has been such an extremely sobering and illuminating read for me. The mechanism, what it is that's happening in child development, what it is that children need to learn to become functioning adults, and the multiple ways the way they are living is stopping that. I would enormously recommend it to readers. But what are your hopes for it? If it does what you hope, what you long for, what will it change?
So first, I'm in the very enviable position that I'm trying to create social change. I'm trying to change childhood. I'm trying to roll back the phone-based childhood and restore the play-based childhood. And that sounds insane. That sounds like an insanely ambitious project to change childhood, not just in America, but in all of the English-speaking countries. Northern Europe, too, they have to share the problem. But I think the English-speaking countries are all tied together. But I'm in the enviable position that almost everybody is fed up with the phones. The parents hate them. It's their main worry about childhood. It's not that their kid will get pregnant or abducted. It's literally that they're going to be scrambled by this phone-based life. Everyone hates it. The right and the left actually agree. It's one of the only issues in America where left and right agree. The kids don't even like it. If you survey them, surveys show if you say, TikTok and Instagram were never invented, would the world be a better place? They mostly say yes. They wish it didn't exist. Why are you on it then? They all say the same thing. Because everyone else is. I have to be. So it's a social trap. It's what's called a social, it's called a collective action problem in the social sciences. We're all stuck in a trap because each person feels that they have to do this thing. It is best for them to be on. And each parent feels that, oh, okay, my kid wants a phone, and she says she's the only one without one and she's excluded. So, okay, I have to give her a phone. So we all do the same thing. We don't want to do it, but we all do the same thing because everyone else is. And we've studied collective action problems for a long time in the social sciences. We know how to solve them with collective action. So you need clear norms, and you need to change incentives. And sometimes you need laws, but often you can do it without laws. So what do I hope to accomplish? The conclusion we come to in the book, the conclusion, you know, as I go through, you know, as you said, what is childhood? How do we mess it up? I show that phones are experience blockers. As soon as you give a kid a phone, it's like, think of all the things that kids might do. They might see friends. They might have a hobby. They might read books. They might ride a bike. Think of all the things that you might want a child to do. Now cut all of those by 80 to 100%. Just put this in their face and this is it. This is the thing they're going to do for the rest of their life. This is going to be most of their day. It's, you know, 9 or 10 hours a day for most kids. So a phone is an experience blocker. Once you give your kid a phone, there'll be very little experience of life other than through the phone. So this is a complete disaster. This is, human beings cannot develop in this way. And we're seeing the evidence of that. So what do I want to do? Four norms that will solve four collective action problems and will largely roll back. I think we can reduce the rates of mental illness, not back to 2012 levels all the way with these four norms, but I think we can get halfway there at least. Four norms. The first is no smartphone before high school. So high school here is the transition between middle school. It's around age 14, roughly, you start high school. So middle school kids should not have smartphones. Now people think, well, how are they, you know, how are they going to get to school? How are you going to reach them? Flip phones. Give them a flip phone. Yeah. Flip phones are great because they're not easy to text with. With a flip phone, you can say, I'll be home in 15 minutes, but you're not going to write a long thing about your emotions. With a smartphone, you will. So give them a flip phone. That's the first. No smartphone before high school. Just use flip phones or watches. There are all kinds of watches that could work. Second norm, and so that would solve the problem. That would solve a lot of the problem for middle school, all the way up through middle school. Now you have to also look out for tablets and computers. So it's not, you know, there's so much technology, but let's start with the phones. The second norm is no social media until 16. The current legal age is 13 and it's so completely unenforced that any 10-year-old can just lie and say she's 13 and she can get an account anywhere. You know, you can go on any porn site. You know, you say, yes, I'm 18. I mean, it's insane what we've done. So no social media till 16. And there are several bills in the United States and some states that will raise the age to 16. I think that should be the age. And it can't be on the parents because the parents can't stop the kid from getting to the internet. You know, it's not enough to say you can't have the app on your phone. If the kid can get to the internet, they can have 17 Instagram accounts. So we have to have a clear rule. No social media till 16. I hope we'll get a law raising the age from 13 to 16. But, you know, even if we can just get most parents to do it, that will relieve the pressure on other parents because your kid can't say everyone's on it. They're not. Only some kids are on it and you're not going to be one of them.
Yeah.
Third norm is really easy and we're actually making a lot of progress. Oh, in England. Okay. So the third norm is phone-free schools. Most schools say they ban phones. What they mean is our rule is you're not allowed to take your phone out during class. Which is complete nonsense because as my kids will attest, that just means you have to hide it in a book or you hide it in your lap. That's the rule. You have to hide it in your lap or go to the bathroom, whatever. And then the teacher has to play phone police and they hate it and they give up. And then you can just use your phone. So that's what most schools do in the United States. And that is a complete waste of a school day. Why send them to school if they're just going to be on their phone all the time? They might as well just stay home. So the rule has to be, when you enter school, the phones go in a locker or a yonder pouch, a lockable pouch. And then you get it back at the end of it. It has to be the rule for all school from kindergarten through 12th grade. And that's actually happening. And in England, I believe it's England-wide. There was some instruction. I don't know how it's being implemented, but clearly you're
not
doing
fully
that as a whole country.
But it's changing.
Yeah, that's right. And my hope is that when the book comes out, it comes out in the UK the same day as the US on March 26th. My hope is that in England, you have a much more functional political system than we do, that both your politics, I don't care how bad yours is.
I think
it's
you might
better
be true,
ours.
But it's just unusual to hear it.
Yeah. I mean, do you have one of your leaders saying that it's okay with him if Vladimir Putin attacks allies if they don't pay their dues? I mean, our system is now completely bonkers. So the third norm is phone-free schools.
Yeah.
And the fourth norm is far more childhood free play and independence. Kids have to, and in the UK, you don't have nearly the crime that we had here in the 70s and 80s and 90s, but yet you did the same thing as us. There's a wonderful book by, you have a British sociologist, Frank Furedi, who wrote a book called Paranoid Parenting, and he documents what happened in the UK, same as the US. Fears that pedophile scandals, the Catholic Church, Boy Scouts, you know, everybody's going to molest your children. And sometimes there was, some of those were true, some were not. But you all locked up your kids too, and don't let them out until they're 10 or 12. And it's too late. It's too late for them to learn to be independent.
I imagine there's a lot of people listening who are concerned and want to learn more and work out how we can build that collective action movement. Where should they go?
Well, I hope that people buy the book, because that really lays out the action plan in part four of the book. But you don't need to buy the book to learn what this is about. If you go to my Substack, afterbabel.com, after B-A-B-E-L, I hope listeners will sign up for that. It's free. You don't have to pay anything. Everything is available. That lays out the research. It has all kinds of essays for teachers, for parents, for legislators. And then I hope people will go to the webpage for the book, which is anxiousgeneration.com. It'll have a lot of resources, again, for teachers, parents, and legislators. It'll have links to videos, and we're doing a kind of a guerrilla art project, which will be featured on the site, but it'll use a variety of installations to dramatize what we've done to childhood.
Wow. One final question. How has it changed how you live?
Oh, well, it certainly has changed the way my wife and I raise our kids. We became friends with a woman named Lenore Skenazy, who wrote a book called Free Range Kids. And that really encouraged us to send our kids out, beginning when they were about 8 years old. We live in New York City, and it was extremely safe in the 2010s. It's a little more dangerous now, though still not bad. But that really encouraged us to send our kids out to the park to play, out to stores to do errands. And when they would come back from those trips, they'd be just like bubbling. Like, they were thrilled to have that independence, because no other kid gets that. You do not see 8-9-year-olds out in the United States. I mean, rural areas you might, but in most parts of the country, you know, if an 8-year-old is spotted alone, someone's going to call the police, because no one has seen an 8-year-old unchaperoned since the 90s. So it certainly has encouraged us to give them more independence and delay access to smartphones and especially social media. You know, a theme of the book is that we have overprotected our kids in the real world, where they need a lot of experience. We've underprotected them online, where they're entering an environment that is really unsuitable for human development.
Jonathan Haidt, thank you so much for speaking to me on The Sacred.
My pleasure, Elizabeth.
Well, I think a lot about formation and the ways the environments that we spend a lot of time in shape our values and our professional worlds, our professional lives are so much a part of our formation. I wonder if careers guidance counselors should be asking children when they're choosing the career they want, not just, you know, does it sound interesting? Will it make you happy? Does it make enough money for you to live on? But what are the kind of souls that are shaped by this particular professional path? What are the ways it's going to continually, what are the things it's going to continually reinforce in you? And one of the really positive things I see in academia is about this concern for truth. It's often the thing that academics say as their sacred value. You know, what does it mean to really rigorously chase down something in my particular field? What does it mean to cope with the discomfort that can sometimes bring? I was really grateful to Jonathan because he was honest. I often ask people about when they have felt their sacred values have been compromised or they have been tempted to compromise their sacred value. It's a very intimate thing to ask someone, especially if you haven't connected with them previously, like I haven't with Jonathan. And, you know, he didn't admit to a big scandal, but he said something very human and very honest, which is at some point in his academic career, he was really tempted to fudge the evidence. And we know this happens, right? I've had previous guests who've talked to this, who's name has temporarily escaped me, but I've also had Tom Chivers on, who co-hosts the podcast with that person about studies, what the studies show. And both of them and other people in the field have done a lot of work at showing where actually the practice of science is almost as much prey to this instincts in us as anything else, that it is really easy for kind of the studies which don't show anything to get buried, you know, or people to just change the p-value or adapt their question to get the results that they need, because that is what the incentive structure is set up around. And that is how you progress in academia. You show really interesting and new research. And I think that it was really helpful for Jonathan to acknowledge that, or probably everyone in that field has felt that temptation at some point. It's very humanizing. And I think we're so judgmental, aren't we, about other people's failings, and so permissive about our own. So I'm just really grateful for him for that. And it did, I mean, I'm thinking about this for other reasons, but it did make me think about how there are really bad ways in which academia can form you. And I think one of those ways is it's very lonely and very competitive. It's not at all collaborative, or lots of fields aren't actively collaborative. And that forms you in a particular way, and I think can leave you without those rigorous, morally formative communities where you're really honest and up close with other people working on something together. It's very much kind of, too often, not always, you know, carve the lonely path as a as the most intelligent and successful individual you can become. So yes, the Bible made him an atheist. This is, you know, blunt summary, but lots of things, it sounds like, led to his loss of faith. But one of them was really reading the Hebrew Bible properly, and it probably stuck out to me because that happened to me too. After I became a Christian in my teens, I had spent some time reading the Bible in quite a shallow way, I think, just reading the nice bits and reading the verses that you could put on a fridge magnet or a lovely Instagram square, you know, in beautiful hand lettering. You know, the plans he has for you, says the Lord. And I hadn't ever really developed my ability to read it in community or with rigor. I hadn't developed my hermeneutics, is the technical term within that bit of academia. And so it fell apart for me too. And a lot of my reconstruction / reconnection with my tradition has been about learning how to read this rich, strange, beautiful, compelling, fascinating, complex, complex, complex book. Yeah. And I wonder for how many people that's Jonathan's experience rings true as well. I loved him talking about the role of music and the aesthetic part of his religious practice. You know, he's an atheist who's a member of a synagogue, and how it really plays into this thread we were pulling on about different forms of attention. And I will point listeners who are very confused by all the Ian McGilchrist chat to an interview I did with him. But that's very much about the person. If you want to just get an overview of his ideas, Nick Spencer did two great podcasts with him on his two most recent books. Or a friend of Theos's called David McElroy has written a really good long read overview on the Perspectiva Substack. For lots of you, this is not going to be interesting, but for the nerds out there who want to chase this down, that's where I would send you. But in very, very oversimplified summary, Ian McGilchrist's work has really developed the sense that the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere pay different kinds of attention, and that because our brain is plastic, which means it is continually changing, the more we pay one particular type of attention, the more that attention gets reinforced, and it gets harder to use the other form of attention. And his sort of big thing is that we live in a very left hemispheric world, which is abstract. It likes parts of things, not wholes. It doesn't see connections, doesn't see animated creatures often. It's sort of reducing things down into the most mechanized parts, whereas the right hemisphere pays attention in this interconnected holes, sees connections, and it's where the imagination and intuition and religion and a bunch of other things that we really need sort of rest or sit. Although Ian would tell me off for oversimplifying, because both parts of the brain do all kinds of different things. It's very complicated, but that's the headline. And this has really formed my thinking hugely. on lots of things, but one of them is why for some people does the religious instinct feel so common, easy, embedded, that the intuition that there is something beyond us that we want to connect with feels very present in some people and very absent in other people. And what does that mean for the way we would choose or choose not to engage spiritually and philosophically? And so that was the sort of hypothesis I was putting to Jonathan. Is part of this about the way we have chosen to pay attention? Is part of this about our formation? You know, the worlds that we've been in, is it easier for artists, for example, to keep open the possibility of there being love beyond us because of the way they've paid attention than it might be for someone who spent a lot of time breaking apart information into its component parts, for example? I don't know. It sounded like he didn't think it was, you know, way left field. And partly because that's what's part of his life, you know, that there's something about the music, there's something about the ritual, there's something about the community that for him, his religious faith isn't about propositions. I don't know if I could call it religious faith. His religious practice is not about propositions. It's about these other things. And all of this has led to why I am sort of increasingly, there's this, Theos does a lot of work on sociology of religion, the study of religion. And one of the things that sociologists of religions talk about is believing, belonging, and behaving. And I think in a sort of post Enlightenment, post Protestant Reformation West, we have come to see religion as all about the believing bit. If we, you know, Freddie said, the reason I'm not Christian is I don't believe it. But it's also about belonging and behaving, sounds like, you know, good behavior, but I just mean, you know, doing, being, enacting. Believing and behaving, belonging and behaving, that those things form us, and they form us in ways that are really hard to separate from the believing bit. And if you just try and go at one, you can't really understand what's going on. That's my current soapbox. Changing minds and changing tribes. This thing about being a Democrat and going mad at the Democratic political machinery about how they communicate fascinates me. One of the roads untraveled is I could well have ended up being someone who did that kind of work in sort of comms theory, you know, storytelling for social change type thing. It still fascinates me. There's this organization called the Frameworks Institute. I just love it. That's a particular sort of nerd ground zero for me. And it really feels to me so important for how we are in the world that both what we believe, what our values are, and then how we communicate them matter. That we can communicate them in ways that do not take into account where other people are starting from, and feel very pure in doing so, and fail to persuade anyone, or even encounter each other. Or we can listen to where someone else is coming from. What is the language that they're comfortable with? What are the values of theirs that we connect with? And be someone who can communicate across those differences. And it, again and again, I think about the world we are creating if we are not someone who's prepared to do that work, if we're not someone who's prepared to be associated with people not like us, not prepared to listen to people like us, not like us, you know, is quick to write people off. In Anand Giridharadas's book, The Persuaders, he talks about this very strong tendency to write people off. That if we do that, our world will shrink and we will end up on a lonely island. But we will also lose that language and we won't be able to communicate across those differences. We'll be like those like terrible English tourists that show up in sitcoms who go other places in the world and think that they're going to be able to get what they need by shouting louder rather than attempting that work of translating across those tribes. And how much I don't think we've seen that as part of our work as citizens, as part of our soul work, as just part of being a sort of responsible grown-up person, to do the work, to communicate, to listen, to hear, to maintain the ability to speak a common language. Sorry, ranting. And because of all that, how easy it is to be misunderstood. And I really did have one of those experiences where some of the sort of ambient associations with Jonathan that I went into reading his most recent work with, and then what that recent work was actually like, was so different. and how easy it is to be misunderstood and how things get translated into short, headline, snappy, tweetable, memeable form that does violence to people's work and they can't help but be misunderstood. That's really scary when you've got, you know, a book coming out and are trying to be someone who writes in public also, just the sort of, going to be misunderstood. You can do all the work. Try and communicate across differences and you might still be misunderstood and people might, well, you know, take exception to you for some really good reasons. And I'm sure that's part of what's going on both here and in my future scenario also. And finally, landing on the anxious generation. And this is what really came out from reading Johnson's work, how much two things can be true. That you can have a rising generation that are more alert to some real deep-seated injustices, which are, you know, a stain on our societies. And that the way those conversations about those injustices are happening can also really not be serving that generation that are alert to them, might actually be harming the generation that is alert to them. And just how complex that is. To be able to say the yes and, not just the no but, to be able to affirm what is good in some of these movements and these moments, what is necessary, even though it's deeply uncomfortable, and steady enough to say, what about a different story? What about a different frame? You know, what does it mean to see ourselves as sort of fundamentally resilient? What does it mean to see ourselves as capable of crossing these divides? So yes. And finally, I'm just really grateful for what's happening around smartphones. This Jonathan's book that's coming out around now has been really key, along with some other thinkers, in creating a tipping point. I've been following his Substack After Babel for a while, and it's partly what convinced me to really hold the line around some things in our family, that and the work of Andy Crouch. And but I tried to build a little group of parents around it a couple of years ago to say, let's be the people that hold the line on this. And it was incredibly difficult and there was almost no appetite and a bunch of people felt judged. I didn't mean to make them feel judged. Now there's a movement for collective action and that is incredibly hopeful making because you don't often get to see the tipping point when the sort of long patient slogging away for change actually makes things move. So I'm hopeful about that. And I'm aware that there will be some parents who are a few years ahead of me and my kind of cohort who didn't have strong evidence and didn't have the strength for collective action and a generation of teenagers that, you know, got smartphones and social media really quite young. And I think as this change happens, I really hope we can not create another divide around that. And that as parents, as people who make choices on the best information that they have, we can just avoid as far as possible either judging each other or assuming judgment. Because this is so tender, right? It's about kids and harm and health. It's all very live and very emotional and very easy to feel defended and defensive and judgy and judged. And so my word to myself, and I hope into this moment, is let's just keep soft hearts towards each other as this big, big change in attitudes happens, partly driven by Jonathan's work. Thank you so much for listening to me on The Sacred. Our production team are Dan Turner, Fiona Hanscom, and Drew Hawley. And I want to give really special thanks this episode, as we draw this series to a close, to Sienna James, who's been helping us with our transcripts. And those are important for accessibility reasons. And I know some of you really like to go back and track down references and lift out quotes. And lifting out quotes and sharing them on social media is a great way to bring awareness to the podcast, because as always, it so helps when you tweet or share posts on any of your social media platforms, or send episodes to a friend if that's much more your style. We love it when that happens. I will be back next week for our series reflection, and then we're taking a break. But until then, I really hope you've enjoyed listening.